Yeah, it says we're supposed to start with some humor, so Yoshua, we were Yotze, Yishkach. We're holding Parshas Matos Maaseh. This week we read both Parshiot together. I think for now we're going to stick to Parshas Matos. And tomorrow night we'll try to do Parshas Maaseh. Just because I'm not sure we're going to get to Maaseh tomorrow night. So in our overview at least, we'll review Maaseh also. Our Parsha begins with... this is our quick overview. 5 minutes and then we do in depth. Our Parsha begins with the laws of vows, that a woman can take a vow and a man can take a vow. And if a woman is a minor, then her vows aren't vows. Only once she reaches the age that she's fit to understand what a vow is, nearing the age of 12, and from the age of 12 to 12 and a half, once she's brought 2 hairs, that period when she's a naira, so then she can take a vow, and her father can annul her vow. When he hears it, if on that day he says, no, it's not a good vow, so he could do hafara, he could annul the vow from that minute onward. She gets married, so husband, the same thing. On the day he hears it, he can annul her vow, provided that the father or the husband did not give the vow strength. If the husband or the father, when they heard the vow, approved it, so then they could no longer annul it, and we have a mitzvah that we have to keep our vows. Now, ideally, we're not supposed to take vows, we're not supposed to take nidarim, but if we do, we're obligated to keep them. The truth is that if we do, we're supposed to go to a rabbi and find a way of annulling the vow. A rabbi can annul a vow, and when a rabbi annuls it, that's called hatorah, undoing a vow, and a rabbi can undo it retroactively. When a father or a husband annuls it, it's from that minute on, and that's called hafara. God tells Moshe, go take revenge from the Midianites for what they've done to us. God doesn't elaborate as to what this revenge should be. Should we throw missiles at them? Should we call them dirty names? Should we say we don't like you? What does it mean, take revenge? So Moshe gathers 1,000 people from each tribe, which is a little bit weird. Why not take the full force? And Moshe says, go take revenge from Midian. And lo and behold, they come back and they've destroyed Midian. They've conquered Midian. Moshe told them, take revenge. Attack. Do some terrorist attacks on them. He doesn't tell them to destroy Midian. He says, take revenge. And they come back and they say, we've conquered Midian. God made it that they won the war, even though they were numbering only 12,000 soldiers. They come back and they bring back the loot. And Moshe and Aaron come out. And Elazar, the Kohen Gadol, come out to greet them. And they see that they brought the women back. Now, what was this revenge for? This was revenge for the fact that they sent their women to cause us to sin. So now they go to war and they bring the women back with them. So Moshe says, what's going on here? They're the ones that caused the problem to begin with. You brought them back. So then Moshe goes, Elazar reviews with them the laws of vessels, and this is the source of the laws of kashrus when we purchase vessels that were used with non-kosher food. And this is also the source of another series of laws, the laws of tvilas kelim. When we purchase vessels from a non-Jew, the second they switch ownership from non-Jewish ownership to Jewish ownership, so then they have to be immersed in mikveh waters. And these are two separate, totally separate laws. Both are relevant when they come back from Midian and they've conquered the Midianite vessels. So the Midianite vessels have been used with non-kosher food. So we have to purge the non-kosher flavor from the walls of the vessels. And we also have to toivel the vessels. We have to immerse them in the mikveh waters. And we're holding by Revi. God tells Moshe how to spoil the loot and what taxes to take off for the Kohanim, for the Levim. And we're holding by Shishi. The tribe of Reuben and Gad have a lot of cattle. They've got a lot of cattle as part of the spoils from Midian. And now they walk in before Moshe and they say, look, this whole portion on the eastern side of the Jordan, what's going to be with all that land? We have so much cattle. Let us have this land for us. And and Moshe tells them, wait a second. Are you trying to do what your forefathers did? Are you scared because of what the spies said 40 years ago, 39 years ago? The spies said that we don't stand a chance, so you guys think you got your portion and you're going to take it easy here. You're not going to go to war to conquer the land of Israel. So they say, no. We'll also go and conquer the land of Israel. And then we'll come back. And here Moshe makes a deal with them. He says, if you keep your end of the deal, then you could have this part of the land. And if you don't, then the tribes, I'm telling them now, they should come back here, destroy these cities, take your wives and children, and force you to live in the land of Israel with them if you try to breach our contract. And here we have, from here we derive the laws of contracts, how one makes a t'nai. How do we make a condition? There are laws in halacha, how to make conditions, and we derive them from here, from the condition that Moshe makes legally with the tribe of Reuben and Gad. They stay, they set up their families there, And the end of the parasha records how different people conquered different parts of the eastern part of the Jordan. And we also find an unusual thing that half the tribe of Menashe is allotted a portion with the tribe of Reuben and Gad, and they didn't even ask for it. So that we'll discuss when we do the parasha more in depth. And now we'll quickly run through Parshas Maaseh as part of our overview, even though I don't think we'll get to do it in depth today. The parasha begins by recording our journeys throughout the desert, and the Rambam says in Mor Nevuchim, the idea was one of the great miracles that the Jewish people encountered was that they lasted. 2 million people traversed the desert, and they lasted. So someone might think, yeah, they planted things, they lived off the vegetation, they went to oases, they of course they managed, they bought food. So the Rambam says that's why the Torah enumerates exactly where we traveled. And anyone who thinks that should go and travel and see this area. The Pasuk tells us place by place where we traveled. And anyone can go and see that it's impossible for 2 million people to stay alive over there. And the Rambam says this is one of the miracles of the Torah. The fact that the Jewish people survived when crossing such a desert, 2 million people. And we have a tradition, the Torah tells us, that the man fell down and God sent them a miraculous well. And someone might think, yeah, these are allegories. It doesn't mean literally, you know, they had some kind of well. They figured out ways of getting underground water. So the Rambam says, the Torah enumerates exactly where we traveled so that anyone who wants could go and check and see that it's impossible for 2 million people to live in such circumstances. After Moshe enumerates our traveling throughout the desert, we're holding by Shlishi, so we have the commandment to conquer all of the land of Israel. God says you're going to be tempted to leave little pockets of people lying around from your enemies, and you should know that that's going to harm you terribly. If you want the land of Israel, you have to conquer all of the land of Israel. And if you leave behind any of the land of Israel, then they'll ultimately grow and they'll become your main enemy. And there'll be a constant pain for you in the land of Israel. And you'll see ultimately that you'll feel like strangers in the land because of the people that you've left behind. Which is interesting because today that's pretty much what's happening. The people that were here, we see today. And we also know that when King Solomon went to war, so there was one nation where he left behind one child. And that child went and grew up and he amassed armies. And at the end of King Solomon's life, that one child was the one that was King Solomon's nemesis. He made all the problems for King Solomon's empire. So the Torah tells us, you want the land. We know how, that when we entered the land, we offered the nations three choices. Either make peace and accept the Noahide laws, or leave, or fight. But if you fight, then it's to the end. If you fight, if you reveal that your intent is to fight for this land, so it's to the end. And God says, if you're going to fight, then you have to fight to the end. Inherit all of the land. We have a commandment. Once we enter the land of Israel, we're supposed to divide it. And in Parshas Maaseh, we have an enumeration of the exact borders of the land of Israel. The borders that we discuss, that's all in this Parsha, in Parshas Maaseh. We have an enumeration of the new Nisim. This is a new generation. 40 years have passed. So the Torah enumerates the heads of each tribe. And then we have the commandment to take off cities that would be given to the Levites. We know the Levim were not given a portion in the land. They were not part of the agrarian society. Their job was to be the educators. So, nonetheless, they have to have a place to live. So the Torah says we have to give them their 48 cities. And then we have the commandment of making cities of refuge. We know that when... who was the first murderer in Tanakh? Who was the first murderer in history? So we would say it was Cain. So the Medrash says it was Adam. Because God told Adam, if you eat from the fruit, you're going to bring death to the world. So Adam, so to speak, killed himself. He ate from the fruit. What was Adam's punishment? God said, get kicked out of Gan Eden. He has to go to exile. So what does the Torah tell us happens when a person kills by mistake? If a person kills by mistake, so then he has to go to a city of refuge. He has to go to exile. And we have three on the eastern side of the Jordan, three on the western side of the Jordan. It's interesting that three cities aren't enough for 10.5 tribes, or 9.5 tribes in the land of Israel. And you need three whole cities, the equivalent for the 2.5 tribes on the western side of the, on the eastern side of the Jordan. I'm sorry. So our sages say, yeah, Begilat Shchichi Rotzchim, that the eastern side of the Jordan, their kids didn't turn out well. And there are a lot of murderers. There are a lot of people running cities of refuge. So there's a famous comment here by Rav Hershel Schechter. He said that when we entered the land of Israel, so in Parshas Matos, we're going to learn how the tribes, these 2.5 tribes, made a deal. we'll go in and help conquer the land of Israel. And only after we conquer the land of Israel, we'll come back home. The Medrash says they kept their end of the deal, we know. So the Medrash says that there, what happened was you had 14 years where all the fathers were out fighting war. And all the mothers were bringing up the kids as single parents. So the kids were growing up only with mothers. So the Medrash says the fathers would grow their hair long and their beards long and mourning that they missed their kids. And the kids, as they grew up, would grow their hair long and their beards long and mourning that they missed their fathers. Bottom line, you had a whole generation, the first generation in the land of Israel on the eastern side of the Jordan of these 2.5 tribes, the first generation were single parent children. And Rav Hirsch Schachter says that that might be why it evolved, that we see that morally this eastern side of the Jordan, they succeeded less. They were the first to be exiled, these 2.5 tribes. They were the most powerful. That's why they dared take these inside of the Jordan. They said, we can handle it. Even if we're attacked, we're okay. But at the end of the day, they were also there was a lot of violence there. And that's why they needed 3 cities of refuge just for that side of the Yarden. Good question. If we get a chance, remind me, and then the answer to that will take 2 or 3 minutes. Remind me, we'll get to that. And the Torah warns us that there has to be justice in the land, and that the land, this is a holy land that will not condone injustice. And the book of Bamidbar ends with Shiduchim, that the tribes come forward and they say, you know, these daughters of Tzlafchat, it's nice they inherited their father, but if they marry out of the tribe, so then they will ultimately, when they pass away, their husbands will inherit them, their children will be from another tribe, they'll inherit them. And we have a law that God institutes only for this generation, that this generation, these generations, the women were supposed to marry within their tribe. We're coming near Tisha B'Av. We're nearing the 9th of Av, and we know the 9th of Av is our great day of mourning. That's when both temples were destroyed. After Tisha B'Av, almost a week later, 6 days later, we hit the 15th of Av. And the 15th of Av historically was a time of rejoicing in the land of Israel. And no one knows why. The Gemara asks why, and the Gemara gives many different reasons. And one of the reasons that's offered is that this was the day in which the rabbis instituted that we may intermarry between tribes. Until a certain year, the 15th of Av, they kept this law that the Torah says, that they'd only marry within their tribe. So you had segregation within the land of Israel. You had each tribe was only marrying within their tribe. And on the 15th of Av, when they finally ruled that this law doesn't apply, so that's when they instituted a day of celebration and a day of Shiduchim. 15th of Av. Those of you who are into dating, you should know that the Shidduch scene is packed towards the 15th of Av. There are all kinds of events. Also Shabbos Nachamu, there are all kinds of events. It all goes back to this. And we end the book of Bamidbar with the end of Parshas Maaseh. Yeah. Okay, so let's review the parsha now with a little bit more depth. Yeah. You'll see signs. You'll see signs all around. They post signs. You'll see in the newspapers also. I don't know. Depends which event. I don't have information on what's current this year. I know in the United States, in the mountains, they have all kinds of events. For Shabbos Nachamu and for Shabbos Nachamu.
And what's that, Shabbos Nachamu?
That's the Shabbos after Tisha B'Av, which is around the 15th of Av. But here in Israel, they seem to stress the 15th of Av more than Shabbos Nachamu. That's like the Valentine's Day around here. Okay, we're starting Parshas Matos again. Okay, sorry, okay. I guess I don't know what Valentine's Day is all about. Okay, we're starting Parshas Matos again. And it's a little bit strange that towards the end of the book of Bamidbar, now suddenly we have these laws of vows. So the question is, what's it doing here? So one understanding is that what is a neder? The Torah tells us that we may bring sacrifices. And before we bring a sacrifice, we designate the animal. Ordinarily, this was done at the temple itself. We'd say, this animal is going to be for an olah. I'm hereby donating this animal for such and such a sacrifice. Now, once I take a vow and I say, I will give this animal for a sacrifice, that's a neder. I say, I will do this. I say, this animal is the sacrifice, that's another form of a neder. It's called a nedava. Our parsha is continuing that concept. We had in last week's parsha, the Torah told us that you bring on the holidays the required sacrifices, and aside from that, that's the time when you pay up your dues, what you owe, what you've taken vows to bring sacrifices. When you come on the 3 regalim, the 3 festivals, you bring the sacrifices that you've taken a vow to give. And now the Torah's elaborating, the Torah's giving us a new concept within the framework of Nedarim, and the Torah is saying, let's say a person sees he has an issue, he's gaining weight, the doctors tell him it's dangerous for his health, he has to stop eating meat. And the guy loves steak. So the Torah tells us he could take a neder. What's a neder? He says, from now on I take a vow that every steak is for me like a holy animal. A neder is that we take something that God gave it holiness, and we say something else will have, I will treat something else with the equivalent status. And in doing that, one has taken on a vow that's called a neder. Notice, a neder is focused on the item, what's called the cheftza. It's the, I'm applying with my mouth holiness, or I'm separating myself from an item. A shvua, a vow, is when I'm talking about myself. If I say, I won't eat steak, I take a vow that I won't eat the steak, that's a shvua. So our parasha focuses on nedarim. Ordinarily we say, if one takes a neder, the halacha is, it's as though he brought an illegitimate sacrifice. Today we don't have a temple, we're not allowed to bring sacrifices. If someone builds his own altar and brings sacrifice, that's a biblical prohibition. Our tradition is that even though the Torah gives us this ability to impart holiness or to impart prohibitions by taking on nedarim, God didn't want us to do this. And God taught us that He created the world in a way that we do have this power with our speech. And that's something that's stressed a lot in Judaism. We value speech, and we say one has to be careful what he says, when he says, how he says, both not to say filthy things and not to hurt people with what he says, and also to impart holiness with one's speech. But God did not want us to start designating things as prohibited things. So God said, you should know, if you do it, it takes effect. If you said, this coffee is hereby on me, like an olah sacrifice, that's it, you can't drink the coffee. But God didn't want us to do it. And if one takes a neder, one should go to a rabbi and try to have it annulled. Because if one takes a neder, it's as though he set up an improper sacrifice. And if one fulfills the neder, if one fulfills the vow, it's as though he sacrificed on that altar. He not only prepared it, but sacrificed it. So this is something people sometimes err on. They take on a neder and then they want to keep it. And really, if you take on a neder, you should go and find a way to have it annulled. Yeah?
There seems to be some rabbinical ambivalence, though, regarding the whole epic capability of a neder. I've heard some rabbis say, well, you know, like I've heard people say that they take a neder, not the vow of silence, you know, this and that. And it's not, apparently, it's not strictly forbidden. How long is it? I don't know if it's all how it works.
What I said, I think, is what it says basically in Shulchan Aruch. There is an exception, we say, at a time of danger, one should take on a vow. One can take on a vow to give tzedakah, but it's not right. One should say, Bli neder, I'll give this tzedakah. One should give the tzedakah. If one is in a time of danger, then he could say, God, save me from this, and I take a vow that I will do such and such. Then it's okay. But ordinarily, one should try and say, I'm doing this Bli neder. I don't want this to be a vow. One second. Zev, are we okay?
I believe so. It seems like I know there one rabbi was pretty mainstream. He said it's not encouraged, is what he said. It's strongly discouraged, but from what I gathered, there was no strict prohibition.
It's strongly discouraged, yeah. I just think people don't take that strongly discouraged enough. So I also quoted the Medrash about the Gemara, about how we treat a neder. Yeah?
People will say, Bli neder, after, agreeing to do something. Is that like a chiyuv? Like we should be really makpid to do that? Say, so, okay, I'll meet you tomorrow at 5 o'clock, Bli neder.
No. I don't think so. I think that things take on mammoth proportions when they enter Mechon Meir. People say Baruch Hashem when you sneeze. Come on. You could say God bless you, fine, but Bli neder is when something that might be a neder. You could say I hope to do it. Be truthful if you're not sure you're going to do it.
So
we have to keep what we say. Just because a person said Bli neder doesn't mean he's not obligated to keep his word. Our word has to be a word. People sometimes say, but I said Bli neder. Good, you didn't take a vow, but you gave your word.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, one is a situation that we agree to do something that, of course, we should carry it out, but we should say Bli neder in order to be quite sure that we're not violating the principle of taking neder.
So Bli neder should be in things where it could be interpreted as a neder. For example, if I say, I won't drink coffee, so that's not really a neder at all. Or let's say I get an aliyah, and the gabbai asks me, how much do you want to donate to the shul? So I should say, bli neder, I would like to donate this. Or I hope to donate this. Because God doesn't like people who take on pledges and don't fulfill them. So better not take a pledge. And if you take it, better fill it. Yeah.
When somebody asks me a question, and I give him an answer, a normal answer, and I don't say brineta. It's my word, I don't make a neder.
Right. Usually. Usually. On things that have to do with situations of donations and things of that nature, so then sometimes it can be interpreted as a neder. For example, when they give him a mishaberach, when you get an aliyah, they say, so and so should be blessed and his family should be blessed in exchange for the fact that he took on a vow to donate X and X. Look what they say. The text says, Bavul Shinadal, because he took a vow. So I always said, Bli Neder, when I was a gabbai. Okay, so it's unclear. Okay, we'll leave that. Okay, so one understanding is that that's why this is here. Because this has to do with the sacrifices that were mentioned in last week's parasha. We said a neder is an offshoot of a sacrifice. We're giving something holiness that's akin to the holiness of a sacrifice. Another understanding is that towards the middle of the parasha, we're going to have the deal with the 2.5 tribes that want to take the land on the eastern side of the Jordan. And Moshe is going to tell them, you guys keep your word. So being that we're discussing keeping one's word in the middle of the parasha, so the Torah put this parsha over here, which is also about one's keeping one's word. This issue of taking vows is something that people have traditionally had issues with. People are quick to take vows and not so quick to fulfill them. And that's why our sages kept warning people, don't do it. God doesn't like that people do it. And even if a person keeps his vow, God doesn't like saying God's name in vain. One has to be on a very high level. The Chazal say one has to be on the level of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that everything he says is truthful, that he's a pious person, a kind person, that he fulfills all the levels of having good traits, and then God says if he takes a vow, it's good. But ordinarily, people aren't on the level, and people should not take vows. The Torah discusses what happens if a woman takes a vow, and her husband hears the vow, and he upholds the vow. He says, fine. Good. She says, a husband can only annul vows that have to do between him and her. Meaning she says, I take a vow I will not shower all summer long. So then a husband can say, I want to annul that vow, and then biblically it's annulled. Let's say the husband says, oh yeah, fine. Okay, you're not taking a shower all summer long. 10 minutes later he says, you know what, never mind. You go take a shower. So halachically he can't do that. Once he upheld her vow, he cannot annul it. She listens to her husband. He just said, I can take a shower. She goes and takes a shower. She transgressed. She didn't keep her vow. So the Torah says, her husband has to seek forgiveness. Why does he have to seek forgiveness? Because in a household, the responsibility of knowing halacha lies on the husband. He's supposed to know the answers. She didn't have to go learn in yeshiva and know the answers. He told her it's okay. She took his word for it. It's his responsibility to verify. So he's held accountable in heavens. What happens if a woman takes a vow? She says, I won't eat chocolate this year. So that's a good vow. It'll help her lose weight. It's not a bad idea. You know what they say. Women like their husbands and like chocolate. But not in that order. Okay, that's what they say. Women say that. So a woman takes a vow, she won't eat chocolate. Right? Her husband hears it. And he goes into a study and he says, it's annulled, it's annulled, it's annulled. Okay, good. She sees a pack of chocolate sitting there. She waits 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour. And by 45 minutes, she takes a nibble. Now, halachically, she's technically, the vow was annulled. But she didn't know that. So then the Torah says, she has to ask for forgiveness and God will forgive her. So from here we derive that it's not enough that technically our actions will be permitted. God also judges us based upon our perception of our actions. If a person walks into the room and sees meat and he thinks the meat isn't kosher and he sits down and makes himself a sandwich and he eats it and then he finds out the meat was kosher, so he can't say, well, I didn't do anything wrong, it was kosher. No, we're judged not only based upon our actions but also what the perception of our actions is. And this is something that Western society trains us against it. Like when you cheat on a test, so a person thinks, I got away with it, what's wrong? No, that's not the point. A person will think, some take this to the extreme. There was once a girl who said, if I'm given a test and the teacher asks me 50 questions, I know the answer to 48, and the other two I don't know. So she said, I'm not allowed to guess. Because if I get it right, I'm getting a better grade than I really deserve, because I didn't know the answer, I guess. So I don't agree with her. Someone told her this, I don't know if it was a real authority, because I think part of what we factor into a test is that you'll guess when you don't know. So she was insistent on leaving her answers blank if she didn't know. But that's the extreme. That's an extreme. But I think that Chazal teaches that not on the extreme. We are responsible for our perception of our actions. A guy can say, I'm speeding on the highway, but I made it home, I didn't kill anyone. Yeah, but the action was an action that endangered people's lives. The fact that we know de facto, we know now that it's the actions came out okay, that's good. I'm happy it came out okay, but that doesn't mean that in heavens they say, you're clean, because the outcome was okay. We're judged also based upon the actions and the perception. Yeah?
So, real quick, back to the husband and the wife. When the husband made the wife take a vow for the shower,
he never makes her take a vow. He can't make her take a vow.
No, but he could...
He could uphold it or annul it. Yeah.
Right. But the responsibility was on him at that point. So, when the wife...
When she takes the vow, it's her responsibility. If he tried to annul it when legally he could not, and she assumes, well, he annulled it, I'm okay, so then we say it was his responsibility to know that he couldn't annul it.
When could he not annul it?
After he upheld it. Even a second later, he can't annul it. After the day he heard it passes. Then also he cannot annul it. Right. He has the whole day. He hears it. If she took a vow at night, she has until the following sunset. If she took a vow in the middle of the day, he has until sunset. He has that day. Yeah.
Two things. As far as I understand, he can nullify at the day he hears it, not at the day she made the...
Correct. The day he hears it. Not the day she made it, the day he hears it. Correct.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And the other thing is... there are vows that a husband can't cancel.
He can only annul a vow that pertains to him.
So
that pertains to the husband.
Daven every day mincha. I can't nullify.
Who said that's a vow? Before you decide what you can or cannot annul, go ask a rabbi. Let's leave it. That's not a... I don't want to go into...
Just an example.
When it comes to a question of lemaaseh, what you do, so go and ask a rabbi.
Everything she does.
Just a second, David's waiting.
Huh.
Yeah.
no, you know,
sorry.
I don't
feel bad.
Wait, hold on. If he doesn't hear the vow, how does that work? If she makes it in her mind.
No, you have to speak out of vow.
Does
but
she have to tell him?
She doesn't have to tell him. He doesn't have to know, but the day he hears, he has that day to annul it.
She starts smelling because she made a vow not to take a shower. Like, he can annul that vow.
When he hears about it.
Like, when he smells about it.
He doesn't know she took a vow. He might ask her, honey, what's wrong? What? Right.
Now, if she says no, like, is that like grounds for divorce?
Yeah.
Because she won't, like, take a shower?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she had that vow. And she won't listen to her husband saying, stop keeping that vow.
Well, let them go to rabbi and work it out. Why'd she take such a vow to begin with? Maybe it was because he wasn't nice to her. I don't know. I mean, let them work it out. Okay, now why is it that we have this concept? Why is it that the Torah gave the husband this power? So the Rambam explains in Mor Nevuchim that the Torah wanted us to have the house a unified front. This is something we've discussed many times. Even though a lot of people here are gerim and chozrim b'tshuva, and they don't have a minig, so you could do all kinds of weird things. You could say, "I'll wait an hour like a Dutchman, and I'll daven like." If you are a Dutchman, but we said that it's important that the house has a normal role that your house will fit with society. That you can say, I keep the customs of these people or these people, even though technically you're not obligated to do that. But practically, your kid's going to grow up and he's going to want to be able to say, yeah, my customs are like this community or that community. Now, by the same token, a husband and wife have to have a single front. One of the worst things that parents can do to kids is to have a contradiction. Because in a child's mind, father's always right and mother's always right. Now, if there's a contradiction between father and mother, so then there's a contradiction in truths. And then that confuses a child. So we have to try to have a unified front in everything. And some people take this very far. They say that it's better to compromise on things which you really, 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 really don't want to compromise, but you're going to do better for the kids to compromise than to have two different fronts. And I think this has very much proven itself. Now, obviously, there's a limit. There is some limit, but the limit is beyond what we would think it ordinarily is. There's a couple that lives here in the community, that she's a religious Orthodox Jew, and he's a very famous non-religious Jew. He's very famous. He's a big person. I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name halachically. He was a big politician, and he lives in the community, and they have a beautiful home. Because to the kids, they respect one another, and as much as they can, they have a unified front. He respects what she does. It's an unusual home. It's amazing that they manage. But they've managed. We see the fruits. He happens to be an amazing person. But at the end of the day, they realize that they have to figure out a way of making it work for the kids. So the Torah wanted that parents will be unified. And if a wife takes a vow and she says, I won't eat meat, and her husband says, look, you don't want to eat meat, fine, but I want meat for supper. So she says, I'll make you meat. We'll put a tablecloth for you here, you'll eat meat, a tablecloth for me here, and I'll eat dairy. The Torah didn't want that. Even when it comes to simple, mundane things, the Torah wanted that they eat as a family, that they live as a family. And that's why the Torah said that on things that pertain to him and her, he has the ability to annul it. Now, why is it that he was given the ability and not her? Because when it comes to tendencies, so she has more of a tendency to jump and take things all out. Like, I gave the example to someone, it says, by Samson, he got married, he's holding in Sheva Brachas. Things are hunky-dory, right? They're in their honeymoon, the first week of marriage. And he gives a riddle to the Philistines. And the Philistines can't figure out the riddle, and they tell his wife, get to figure out the riddle for us. So she comes to Samson and she says, Ach, Sinei Tani, you hate me? Veloav Tani, you don't love me? Imagine a husband here, this is the first week of marriage. You can imagine the guy was going out chopping wood, he was bringing home firewood, he was bringing home water, he was bringing home food, he was making parties for all the friends all 7 days. He was working, he was trying to make her happy. And she doesn't say, look, I want you to tell me the riddle. No, she goes all out. You don't love me, you hate me. Well, God made it that women feel things stronger than men. And as a result, their reactions are stronger than men. And women have more of a tendency to say things in a more encompassing manner. Meaning it's not, you love me and you're a great husband in 15 things, but this one point is getting on my nerves. No. You don't love me and you're not treating me well. That's what she says. We see it. So because they have a tendency to jump to things quicker than men and to speak in a manner that's more encompassing, the Torah said that the husband should be the one to be able to annul it, or the father in the case of a daughter. But a father with his daughter, it's only a matter of about 6 months that this is relevant. After that, she's on her own. Once she's a complete adult, her vows are her own issue, just like a male. The Torah tells us we're supposed to take revenge from the Midianites. And the question is, what's the idea of this revenge? So, you have a person that's... he walks through the red zone every day. So... he's got a problem. He's got temptation.
Red zone.
He walks through an area where there are immodest people. So he's got a problem. But you have a person that he's living in a nice secluded area and he has no issues whatsoever and he decides, let me go and make someone else sin. That's a totally different thing. When the Midianite women came to seduce the Israeli men, it wasn't a situation that we were next to them. It wasn't a situation where there was something that a person's will overtook him or a person's desire overtook him. No. There was one simple intent. Let's cause the Israelites to sin because God is with them, and if we cause them to sin, he won't be. That's something terrible. When a person sins because he's overtaken with desire, so that's also not good, but that's understandable. But when a nation says, we'll take our princess because she's good looking and we'll send her over in the hopes of bringing Moses down. And we'll take our girls and we'll send them over because we know the only way to bring these people down is by having them sin. So then God says, for that you have to take revenge. That's not a situation where a person was overtaken with desire. So that's why God says, I want you now to take revenge. When God tells Moshe to send the Jewish people out, he says, go take revenge for what happened to the Israelites. And Moshe says, okay, we're going to go take revenge for what they did against God. So what's the discrepancy here? God said, take revenge for the people. Moshe says, we'll take revenge for God. So here we have a medrash, which I think is key to understanding anti-Semitism throughout our history. The medrash says, God told Moshe, go take revenge for me. Go take revenge for my people. My people were harmed, go take their revenge. And Moshe turned to God and he said, this isn't our personal revenge. This is your revenge, God. Because if we wouldn't be Jewish, if we wouldn't keep the Torah, if we didn't have your commandments, no one would hate us. The only reason they hate us, the only reason they're trying to get us down is because of you. So this revenge isn't for us. This revenge is for you. The fact that we're being persecuted is because we're your people. They have nothing intrinsically against us. I think that this is key to understanding. Our sages said that the mountain is called Mount Sinai, right? Why is it called Mount Sinai, explained our sages? Because in Hebrew, the word sin'ah means hatred. And Sinai refers to sin'ah. That when we got the Torah from that mountain, hatred spread to the world. The second God said, you are my chosen people. Here is my Torah. This is the way I want you to live. That's the second the world started hating us. And that's why it's called Mount Sinai. God tells Moshe, I want you to go fight the Midianites, and then you're going to pass away. So Moshe could have said, okay, God, I'll take care of it. I'll get there. Yeah. Moshe didn't do that. Right away he tells the people, we're going to war, after that I have to pass away. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. That he has a commandment, he wants to fulfill it right away. What's the connection? What's the connection that God says, fight them and then you'll pass away? All the mitzvos that had to do with Chutz La'aretz, that was Moshe's duty. This is what remained from the mitzvos of Chutz La'aretz. After this, the rest of the mitzvos are mitzvos that pertain to the land of Israel. Now Yoshua is going to take over. We're up to Moshe's last 36 days. That's the book of Dvarim. And Moshe is going to give his last speech, and then Yoshua is going to take over. Yeah?
But Yehoshua is already instituted as the leader. How can Moshe tell what's going on?
He's not fully the leader. He's instituted as the one who's going to take over, but not yet the leader. God wanted to give Moshe this honor to see this revenge. And if we have time at the end of class, remind me to get back to this. The Medrash stresses that Moshe wanted to see us avenge what the Midianites did to us. And we have to expand on this, why the Medrash says this. If we have time at the end of class, Bezrat Hashem, we'll get back to it. God had promised Yoshua, just as I was with Moshe, I will be with you when Yoshua takes over the leadership of the people of Israel. And when Yoshua was conquering the land of Israel, God told him, finish conquering the land, divide it between the people, and then you're going to pass away. So Yoshua thought, hey, I don't want to pass away so fast. So Yoshua started taking his time in conquering and dividing so as to live a longer life. And as a result of that, God shortened his life by 10 years. Yoshua died at the age of 110, and God had told him, I will be with you just as I was with Moshe. God's godly plan was that he would have lived 120 years. And this is something that we have to really, we have to absorb. Sometimes in life we think that we have control over time. I remember when I was in yeshiva once, so every time I'd start learning, after a few minutes, someone would come and they'd need help with one thing, with another thing, and every time I'd have to stop, go do it, and come back to learning. So at one point I went to my Rebbe, I said, I know the halacha says that if someone needs your help, you have to stop and help them. But I'm not getting the learning I need done. So his answer was like this. He said, look, the halacha says that if people need you, you have to stop and help them. And you're thinking, I have to accomplish Shas 500 times before I die. Well, maybe God's plan is that you're supposed to live 80 years. And you're supposed to get, let's say, 50 years worth of learning in. If you stop and help people, so that's, you're doing what the halacha says, so it'll take you maybe 100 years to get those 50 years worth of learning in, because you're stopping all the time to help people. So God will give you 100 years to accomplish that. If you think, I won't stop, I won't help people, so God says, okay, you got your 50 years of learning in. We don't know what God's plan is. Yahushua thought he could go against the odds. God told him, your job is to finish conquering the land, then pass away. So Yahushua started taking a long time, at which point God at some point said, okay, make out the maps, divide it on paper, tell each tribe what their portion is, and now you're dying. He died 10 years early. Had he done like Moshe did, taken full control of the job and tried to do it as quickly as he can, we have tradition that he would have lived another 10 years. So we don't know. We have to work with the responsibilities we have and the guidelines we have. Moshe takes 1,000 people from each tribe. Why didn't he take the whole army? Because much of the people of Israel had sinned with the Midianite women. And Moshe said, if this person isn't clean himself, if he fell with the Midianite women, then I can't send him to avenge what was done. I need someone who's a tzaddik, someone who's righteous. So they took 1,000 people from each tribe who everyone knew and recognized they were tzaddikim, that they were clean. Yeah?
How many people did that?
I don't know, but it seems like there were a lot. A lot more than passed away. That there were a lot of, it says that when they came back with the Midianite women, they'd start saying, oh, she's the one he was with, and she's the one he was with. That the people started talking, oh, I remember her. And Moshe said, what is this? What'd you bring them back for? So it seems like there were a lot of people who had sinned. Yeah. The Pasuk says three times there were 1,000 representatives for each tribe. And that's why some want to say that there were really 3,000 from each tribe. 1,000 from each tribe went to war. 1,000 from each tribe were there for support, meaning taking care of the weapons, protecting from behind. And 1,000 corresponding to each person that was at war, there was a person whose job was to stand in prayer. And if you remember a year ago, when we had the war in Lebanon, they gave out bookmarks with the name of a soldier, and they asked that each person should focus his learning is for the sake of that soldier that's out at war. And this medrash is a nice source for that. I don't know if the people who did it knew this medrash, but that's what the medrash says in our parsha. Pinchas leads us to war. God had told Moshe, go fight the Midianites. And Moshe doesn't want to do it, because Moshe grew up in Midian. So Moshe says, this place brought me up. I owe them something. And here we see again the great level of Hakarat HaTov, that Moshe Rabbeinu, one of the signs of greatness is that a person knows to appreciate what others did for him. We always appreciate what we do for others and feel like how much they owe us. And the Torah always trains us to recognize appreciation for what others do for us. So Moshe says, I can't fight them. That's one understanding in the Medrash. Another understanding in the Medrash says, geographically, this isn't the same Midian. The Midian that Moshe grew up in already was destroyed. This is a different nation that was called Midianites, and the reason he let Pinchas lead the war is because Pinchas started. Pinchas was the one who stood up and said, this is wrong. He started solving the problem, so Moshe said, you finish it. They took the chatzotros, they took the trumpets with them to go to war. The trumpets have a special place in Judaism. When we accept Shabbos or Yom Tov, so every Jewish city used to have a person, they used to have a tower in the center of town, and a person whose job it was to go up to that tower and blow the trumpets. He'd blow the trumpets once, it was a sign that the people who were distant from the city had to stop working. He'd blow it again, it was a sign that everyone had to come into the city. He'd blow it again, it was a sign they have to close the shops, they have to put the stuff on the fire. There's a whole sequence of how they'd blow trumpets Friday afternoon as signals for the people that Shabbos is coming in. The last blow was a blow which he'd blow and then put down, and it was Shabbos. They'd have like a few seconds after he blew that trumpet, enough time to put it down, and that's it, it was over. Shabbos was in.
Is this the root of the Minha? Because the day in Ben
Barak? Could be. It's a Gemara in Tamim Madlikin, and it's Paskin and Shulchan Aruch that you're supposed to have blown. Now we have to know that when trumpets are discussed in the Torah and Tanakh, so trumpets don't always mean the trumpets we think of. Trumpets can mean trumpets made of metal. Trumpets could also mean a shofar that's fashioned in a certain way. That's also called a chatzotra. Yeah?
Do we use Moshe's trumpets?
No. No. I don't think so.
They were buried with him.
Yeah. I don't think so, but I have to check. I don't know why I'm so sure that not. I don't know. I have to check. I don't think so, but I have to check. So Shabbos enters with the trumpets. Rosh Chodesh enters with the trumpets. The Yamim Tovim enter with the trumpets. When we travel, we'd blow trumpets to signify that the people have to pack up their goods and start traveling. When the people would gather to hear a speech by Moshe, they'd blow the trumpets to tell people to gather. By the way, in the times of the Gemara, the sign for the kids to gather for learning wasn't trumpets, but rather the bells on the Sefer Torah. The Sefer Torah, they'd carry it with bells, and the kids would hear the bell, and they'd know the Rebbe was going to teach the Torah, and that's how they'd go learn. When there was a danger, we'd blow trumpets to gather in prayer. And when we went to war here, we take these trumpets with us to go to war against the Midianites. A trumpet signifies a special type of prayer, a trumpet, a shofar. When we pray, we speak. But our speech is representative of us with all our complications and intricacies. A trumpet is a wail. The purest form of prayer is a cry. It's no words, it's just the feeling, it's just the connection. And the trumpet represents that. The trumpet, the shofar, when we blow it on Rosh Hashanah, represents the cry. Yilala, yivava. Yeah.
Where's the trumpet at now? Like, how come we're not in trumpets now?
If you go when they have times of prayer at the Kotel, you'll see they do have trumpets. They have Kohanim blowing trumpets.
But usually they have, like, for Shabbat, though, they have the loudspeaker horn. That's like a computerized.
Yeah, that's different. I don't know why they haven't reinstituted it. I don't know. Yeah?
Would they have the whale? There's different kinds of trumpets. In times of
Doesn't have to get to that point, but let's make believe we're having a conversation. And as we're talking, I'm all over.
You what?
I'm not with you. So that's one way of having a conversation. Then we could have a conversation where there's eye to eye contact. And then we could have a conversation where I'm begging. Now, part of what's supposed to happen in prayer is a connection. Meaning, we live our lives in aspiration to be connected every minute with God, but that's difficult to live up to. One of the things that's supposed to happen in prayer is to connect. If I recognize that there really is a ruler of the world, he is running what's going on, even though very often we see things that seem to contradict it, that are difficult to live with and maintain the faith, when one stands up in Rosh Hashanah and declares God is king of the world, and when one stands in prayer, part of what one is doing, one is reconnecting. Now, the deeper one goes within one's heart to reconnect, the more sincere the prayer. I think tears represent, they're a clear representation of what's deep inside one's heart. In today's world, we look down at a person crying. That's, in Western civilization, that's a sign of weakness. In Judaism, we don't look at it that way. We look at it as a person who's speaking forth what's in his heart.
Look, some people, when they cry, they really have to be in a really, really bad situation. I mean, I know myself, I don't just cry easily. I mean, before I cry, I'm gonna be in a bad
situation. So, I don't know if tomorrow we'll have time for this. I want to have a special Thursday night just about crying. Tomorrow night, Bezrat Hashem, we have a class. In Judaism, crying, tears have a very special place, and I hope we're going to have a class just on that. I don't think we're going to get to do it tomorrow. Maybe,
why not tomorrow?
Maybe during the 9 days. I don't know if we'll get a chance because we have a lot of other things we have to do tomorrow. Okay. I don't think so.
What?
The idea is that it's real tears. To stand there and start thinking of the saddest thing you could think of just because you think the tears were something, that's not the idea. The idea is that it's a real representation of where a person's holding. they come to Midian and they kill the kings of Midian and they kill Bilam. Now Bilam was a prophet. How do you kill a prophet? So God had said, kill them because of their attempts to try and make you fool, their plots. Who was the source of the plot? We have tradition that Bilam gave them this advice. There's another understanding that when Bilam wanted to curse the Jewish people, what did he say? He said, I can't curse them. I can't curse. God doesn't want them cursed. God isn't upset with them. Lohibit aven biyakov. God hasn't seen any sin among these people. The people as a whole are whole. Each individual has his lackings. But when he looks at them in general, they're good people. So God isn't willing to curse them. So even in his blessing, Bilam was hinting to them, he was alluding to them, you want to get them down, this is the key. The key is that the people are whole. Bring them down. Someone once said, if we want to solve the Palestinian issue, we have to open up cinemas throughout the West Bank. They'll be less religious. They'll listen to their leaders less, and then we'll westernize them and bring them down. I don't know if he wants me to quote it. No. The people come back from war, and Moshe goes.
Is allowed to make money with such things?
Moshe goes out to greet the warriors, and this is a sign of Moshe's modesty. These are all the students of his students, but they're coming back from war. He goes out to greet them. He's the leader. He goes out to greet them. Moshe sees them coming back, and the women are with him, so he's upset. Moshe gets angry, he forgets. He doesn't remember the halacha. We say, a prophet, if he gets angry, he loses prophecy. A wise man, if he gets angry, he loses his wisdom. The second one's emotions take control over him, so he loses. So that's why who gives the following speech? Elazar teaches them the laws. Moshe forgot. We have three major differences between this war and the one that preceded it. We saw that we had fought Sihon and Og, and now we fought the Midianites. Now suddenly the warriors, when they come back, Moshe tells them, wait out of the camp for 7 days till you're purified. Why didn't we do that in the last war? Because in the last war, everyone went to war. So when everyone's Tameh, so you don't have to wait out of the camp. The whole congregation was Tameh. Here, you only have 12,000 people who are Tameh, so they have to wait out of the camp. When we went to war against Sihon and Og, so there, Moshe didn't tell them you have to purge the flavor of the non-kosher food from the walls of the vessels. Now suddenly Moshe says that. Because when God promised us the land of Israel, God said, I'm going to give you homes filled with good. And we have a tradition that God was saying, during the 7 years that you're conquering the land of Israel, you may eat the pigs that you find. You may eat non-kosher. For 7 years, when we entered the land of Israel, we were permitted to eat non-kosher food. Now, Sihon and Og, which were supposed to be part of the territory we're conquering in the land of Israel, so we don't have to clean their vessels. We don't have to purge their vessels of the non-kosher food. Because the part of conquering land of Israel, we're allowed to eat the non-kosher food. But Midian, that wasn't part of the land of Israel. That was a territory that had nothing to do with the land of Israel. So therefore, we're going to use the vessels. We have to purge them. Just 1 second. And the third difference is that here, we gave taxes. And when we conquered Sihon and Og, we didn't give taxes to the Kohanim and Levim. And again, that's because when we conquered Sihon and Og, that land was supposed to be part of our territory. And God said that when it comes to the territory of the land of Israel, there the Kohanim and Levim have no portion. But when we conquer Midian, that has nothing to do with the land of Israel. So then it's spoils that have nothing to do with conquering the land. So then we divide it equally, including the Kohanim and Levim. They get their taxes. Yeah, Jeff. David, fine. David.
Would that work nowadays? Like the land that we don't have, that we gave away, we decide one day to conquer it.
So the halacha says that when we're at a time of war, if a soldier is hungry, he's in the middle of fighting a battle and he's going house to house and he's in a Palestinian house and he sees a nice hamburger on the table and he wants to eat it, the halacha says he may. Again, this isn't a halacha class. When you want to learn halacha, learn halacha. But in general, we say that if a warrior is at war and he wants to eat, he should eat. He shouldn't go looking for kosher food. Right now he's at war, he has to protect his life, and part of protecting his life is eating what he has to eat. But, okay, then we run into the question, how do you treat the army of Israel today, and how do you treat the wars today, which is a separate question, and that's why I don't want to deal with halacha lemaisa. In general, that's what's brought in the Rambam. The example was just given to, so that we could have we could picture it better. But halacha lemaisa, each person will ask his rabbi. Yeah, Jeff.
So that's one thing that I was going to ask you: is if during 7 years they had to be during, like during the war, or just like anybody could
no.
eat anything?
If I'm not mistaken, it's anybody could eat anything.
Okay, and
it wasn't just during the war. They during those 7 years, if they entered a home after they conquered an area. They finished the war. Now they find pigs in the home, they could eat it.
Okay. Also, we saw with David that one of his wives was a beautiful Catholic woman. He said that, yeah, okay, there's the halacha that you can do it, but, like, not necessarily recommended to. Is that the similar situation here? Like,
it would seem that way, because we say, even in kosher food, that the food affects a person. You are what you eat is a concept in halacha. We say, for example, that the heart, when you eat the heart, then it affects one's ability to understand. So depending on what your work is, if you have to learn things that require great analysis like Gemara, so then you shouldn't eat the heart. If you're not one who's learning Gemara all day, if you're just dealing with you have a business or something that you don't have to sit and delve and think and work out details, then you could eat the heart. So girls who never learned Gemara, they'd always give them the heart to eat. And the guys who they were hoping were learning Gemara, they wouldn't eat the heart. That's in kosher food. And non-kosher food also, the Gemara says it affects a person. So it would seem, I didn't see anyone say it explicitly, but it would seem that this is permitted, but maybe not recommended. Yeah?
Why did you describe the death of Bilam that he was killed in the sword?
There's a long medrash behind that. If you remind me tomorrow night, Bezrat Hashem will do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
But there is a difference when warriors are in fighting and they have need for food. Then it doesn't apply like the 7 years afterwards that he could eat pig.
Right.
He needs to eat something. He's not allowed to take care for kosher.
It's not only if he needs to eat it. It could be he left camp, he was full. A minute later he walks in, he smells a good hamburger.
I mean when he's like in the Lebanon but he doesn't have food.
Right. I'm saying, but even in a situation where it's not that he's that hungry. It's just that he smelt the hamburger and he wants to eat it. Even there, it would seem from the Rambam that if we go back to the times when we were conquering land of Israel or when it was a Milchemet Mitzah, then for sure he could eat it. And what the din is today, each one will have to ask his rabbi.
But the Rabbanut from the army gave a ruling out for that.
Fine. Okay. Whatever the ruling was, I...
What Rambam do you make on that?
Good question. If you remind me tomorrow night, we'll go to it. No, it's the same question as if you have to eat on Yom Kippur, what bracha do you make? Or if for medical reasons you have to eat non-kosher food, what bracha do you make? So if you remind me, Bezrat Hashem, we'll do that. Yeah, it's a siman in Shulchan Aruch. So it's discussed. Yeah.
This question is a little strange for you, but you mentioned the problem that Moshe Rabbeinu has inside himself because of the kesher that was established for people of Midian.
So I didn't say the kesher was established for Midian. I said the akar satov to the people of Midian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How he felt. But I'm curious about if there was anything mentioned in Midrash about how Yitro felt about being a new Jew, so to speak, in his own land.
Remind me tomorrow night. Okay? We'll try to deal with that a little bit. Okay, so now we get to two separate series of laws, and we'll try to at least organize them without getting to halacha lemaisa. We're not going to reach the bottom line halacha, but at least we'll go through the concepts. The Torah teaches us that if we take a vessel and we cook in it, so then some of the flavor goes into the walls of the vessel. And if you'll cook in it a second time, even if you'll just cook water in that vessel, let's say the first time you cook chicken soup, and the second time you just cook water. You finish cooking the chicken soup, you wipe it clean, you fill it with water and you cook it again. Some of the flavor of the chicken soup went into the walls, will come back into the water.
Irregardless of what the vessel is?
For now, we'll say yes.
What
For now, I'll say yes. Yeah. So wait, let's go in order. Let's go in order. And if after 5 minutes you don't have an answer, so then let's deal with specifics. I just think people will get confused if we keep going to tangents. So let's just organize things. I take a vessel. I cook in a chicken soup. I wipe it clean. I cook water. Some of the flavor goes back into the water. I take a grill. I make a mangal. I have a fire. On top of the fire, I have my steak. The steak is roasting. Some of the flavor will go into the grate. I have an oven. Inside the oven, I have the cooking sheets. I make chocolate chip cookies on the cookie sheets. I see salivating here. Okay. My wife has to do that. Some of the flavor is going to go into the cookie sheets. Okay, that's basic. Now.
No,
we didn't say that yet. Wait, slowly. So, what have we said so far? That when food, hot food, boiling food, comes into contact with a vessel, some of the flavor of that food will go into the vessel. Now let's quantify it a little bit more. The Torah says that there's a difference between the amount of flavor that goes into a vessel in which you cook the food and the amount of flavor that will go into a vessel on which you roasted a food. Here you have direct contact with the flame, and here you have, it's cooked in water, but the flame is hitting the vessel and not the food and the vessel. So we have a concept in halacha that's called kiboleo kach poleto. The same fashion that a vessel absorbs flavor, that's the fashion in which it will emit the flavor. So let's say I have my cup here. Whenever I fill my cup with boiling water, I take a pot from the fire. That pot on the fire is called the kli rishon. That's the first vessel. That's the vessel in which it was cooked. That pot certainly absorbed the flavor of the hot milk. And then I pour from the pot into my cup. So now my cup was poured into. To pour is called irui. It was poured from a kli rishon, from the first vessel on the fire, into my cup, which is now a kli sheni. My cup is the second vessel, which contains the hot liquid. Now I take a spoon, and I stir my coffee. So that spoon was immersed into a vessel that had hot liquid, but it is the second vessel, kli sheni. So, what do we have? We have the vessel that's on the fire, that's a kli rishon. We have the pouring from the vessel into the cup, that's irui kli rishon, pouring from a first vessel. And then we have the spoon that went into a kli sheni, that went into a second vessel. And we say that each one of these are levels in how they absorb. There are levels of heat. But notice, we don't measure heat by temperature. We don't measure heat whether it's this much centigrade or this much Fahrenheit. No, we measure it by where it is in relation to the fire. This was a general ruling that our sages taught us. This is how we evaluate it. So now, let's say I come and I have a cast iron pot. I'm purchasing it from a non-Jew. So I can assume a cast iron pot was used for cooking things in it. But maybe he cooked bacon. Maybe he cooked all kinds of things that are not kosher. So I say, how did he cook them in that pot? He had water and he cooked something in the pot. How will I get the flavor to leave the walls of the pot? I fill the pot with water. I boil it. It overflows the way it would, let's say it was cooking. And then I say, kiboleo, the same way it absorbed the flavor. Kach polto, that's the way it emitted the flavor. But now, all you intelligent people have questions, right? Why? I know some people picked up their head. If the flavor went into the water, so a second later it went back into the walls, right? Why doesn't it keep going back and forth, right? So we say like this. When flavor gets absorbed into the walls of a vessel, so the flavor maintains its positive nature for me'et le'et, the first day period. After a day has passed, so then we say, you know what, 24 hours have passed, the flavor becomes pungent. The flavor loses its positive flavor and becomes negative. The flavor in the walls becomes a negative flavor. Now, biblically, if I were to take a vessel, I buy it from a non-Jew, I wait 24 hours, I cook water in the vessel. That water is kosher. Biblically, we say that it gave a bad flavor. That's not really a good flavor that it gave into the water. But we say, rabbinically, the rabbis instituted that we can't rely on this. We can't say, I'll buy vessels that have non-kosher flavor in them, I'll wait the 24-hour period, and then I'll use them as kosher vessels. We cannot rely on this. Rather, the rabbi said, after that 24-hour period, then you can cook water in it, and after you've cooked water in it, the flavor goes into the water and goes back into the walls. But this time it went into the walls as ta'am lifgam, as flavor that's been harmed. It's not a good flavor that went into the walls. When we have a situation that the flavor that went into the walls was already a bad flavor, then we say you could use the vessel. That's what our sages instituted. You guys with me?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what happens if you want to buy a grill set, and the guy has the spoke, and he has the grill, and the grate? How do you purify that? So again, kibole'o, the way it absorbed, kachpolto, that's how it emits the flavor. It wouldn't be enough to put it in a boiling pot, because it was absorbed through fire. So if we want the taste out, we have to put it through fire, or put it in a blowtorch, we have to put it through fire. And that's what you see in preparation for Pesach. We take vessels that are used for chametz with hot. All of this we're discussing hot. Vessels that were used with hot chametz, and we make them go through this procedure. If it was used directly on the fire, for example, a frying pan. Ashkenazim say that little bit of oil doesn't constitute cooking, but rather that constitutes like roasting. It's as though there was no liquid there. And that's why a frying pan, Ashkenazim hold, has to be, in order to make it kosher for Pesach, it has to go through a blowtorch. So no koshering of frying pans for Ashkenazim if they have Teflon. It won't last. There's the issue of the handle. Sephardim are more lenient on this, but this is the way Ashkenazim go. Yeah?
You speak now about things that are used. When I buy something, most of the things are new.
Two things. If you buy it new, so then ordinarily there isn't an issue. The only issue that we have is today, one of the ways they make pots shine is they take pig's fat, and they have a process in which they heat up the metal of the pan, of the pan, and they slowly line the pan or the pot with the fat, and then the pot or the pan is very shiny. So that Ashkenazim hold is problematic. And Sephardim, there are some Sephardi rabbis which are more lenient. You have to verify whether you really have to kosher each pot. Some say that whenever you buy a new pot, you have to fill it first with boiling water and cook in it. A word to the wise, better verify if you have to do this, because it will not look shiny when you're done. Take it from someone who did it to every pot he has. They don't look the same after you've done it. It's not the same to cook something in a pot and to just boil water. For some reason, maybe it's because our water is hard. If you cook just water in a pot, when you're finished with that pot, it's not going to look the same. Even though you brought it to a boil and then you poured it out. Doesn't matter. My experience is that the pots really, really don't look the same. And I don't know why. But if you cook soup in it, if you cook anything else, it's okay. You cook just water, it doesn't come out good.
Water just has a lot of sand and rock.
Maybe that's why. I don't know. It's the same water in the soup. I don't know. Maybe purified water would go better. I haven't tried it. I'm just warning, you're newly married. Don't get your wife upset. you should know the pot, check with your rabbi if you have to do this. Our Sephardi rabbis are more lenient. There are rabbis who say that you don't have to worry about each pot that they did this to the pot. You verify. Okay. Now the next law that we have over here is that when a vessel goes from the possession of a non-Jew to a Jew, that vessel has to be immersed in the mikveh waters. Now this applies to vessels that are used in the preparation of food and that come in direct contact with food. So that means if I have an oven, my oven doesn't come in contact with the food. I have the cookie sheets on the oven, well, sometimes you place food on the cookie sheets. They do have to be immersed. You have a toaster, if it's one of those toasters that have trays, so then the toaster itself doesn't come in contact with the food. The food doesn't touch it, ordinarily. That doesn't have to be immersed in the mikveh. But the trays, where you put the grates, where you put the bread, that has to be immersed in the mikveh. When we immerse something in the mikveh, it should be done by a Jew who's an adult, and it should be done when the thing is perfectly clean. We have to clean it off beforehand. So if you buy a new cup, and that cup has a sticker on the bottom made in China, take off the sticker, clean it off, and then go to the mikveh. Because if you're going to try to take it off, when you get to the mikveh, you'll suddenly discover there's a lot of residue and you can't really get it off, and you get your nails filled with all the gook and you still won't get it off. So clean it off, word to the wise. Before you go to the mikveh, make sure all your vessels are clean. Don't take them in the box. Happened to me many times. I'm telling you, I'm wise when I'm saying it, but when I do it, I always forget. The last two times I remember, but that's after it happening to me many times. Just one second. What vessels have to be immersed in the mikveh? Oh, let's reverse just one second. We did not discuss the difference between vessels when it comes to flavor going into the walls. We didn't discuss earthenware, glass, metals. I'm not going into that today. We will, Bezrat Hashem, at some point have a class on that. And now when it comes to immersing vessels in a mikveh, what vessels have to be immersed? So, metal vessels, the different types of metals, gold, silver, vessels obviously that were purchased from a non-Jew that are going to be used, purchased or given from a non-Jew. They went from non-Jewish ownership to Jewish ownership. They're going to come into direct contact with food, and they are made of the following materials: either one of the metals or glass. The porcelain, or if you look at the ceramic cups that they have today, those cups are glazed. They have a glass glaze on the inside, and some of them have a glass glaze on the outside. So there you have different opinions. Here in Israel, the custom is that we do immerse them. In Chutzlaretz, Rabbi Feinstein held, you do not have to immerse them because the glaze is a very thin glaze. In Halacha, it says you have to immerse them. But he says the Halacha was discussing a glaze that's thick enough that it constitutes its own vessel. Our glaze, the glaze they put on our earthenware vessels, is so thin that if you tried to use just the glaze as a vessel, it wouldn't last. So that's what Rabbi Feinstein held, that our cups, the earthenware cups that you see today, they do not have to be immersed in a mikveh. So if you purchase a vessel and you don't have time to get to the mikveh and you want to use the vessel, so you may not use it. People keep saying you could use it on a one-time basis or this or that. No, you may not use the vessel. What you can do, being that you're here in Machon Meir, is if you have a friend who is in the gear process and he clearly is not a Jew, a lot of people in the gear process are possibly Jewish. We're not sure. We just can't prove it one way or another. But if you have someone who's clearly not Jewish and you want to insult them, so you could say, look, why don't you take ownership of this vessel? If it's yours, I could use it. Meaning, if it goes back to non-Jewish ownership, a Jew may use a vessel that belongs to a non-Jew as many times as he wants. You may use it, so, assuming it's a kosher vessel. So what I did, I once bought a hot water urn and I titled it, and I didn't wait long enough, and I plugged it into the wall, and it's history. So if you're gonna immerse a hot water urn or something like that, you have to wait a while and leave it in the sun till it's fully dry. And I just verified this. Friend of mine this week told me he kashered a hotel. He took 150 hot water urns. They had an hotel, immersed them all in the mikveh, and put them all on the rooftop for 3 days to dry in the sun, and not one went on him. All of them came out okay. So you have to dry them out well, and then it was a hotel. So that's something which you could do. You could give it over to the ownership of someone who is not Jewish, but you have to make sure the person isn't going to be insulted by your doing that, and that's why it's not recommended here at Machon Meir, even though it's feasible. Yeah, Jeff.
I think you have to do it again.
I think so. That's a good question. I don't know. When we make a bracha, so this is one of those interesting brachas that don't show up in the Gemara. We say a bracha sheket shem, and so it's one God commanded us atvias kli, or on immersing a vessel, or kelim, if it's more than one vessel. The bracha should be made in a clean place. Some of the mikvahs aren't clean. If you're going to go to a mikvah where you're not supposed to toivel your kelim in a mikvah that people bathe in, because we're worried that people are going to immerse glass vessels there or knives there and drop them and forget them, and people are going to get hurt. So the halacha says you're not supposed to toivel your stuff there. I think so. Most mikvahs have a separate place where you do it. I strongly recommend the mikvah here on Rav Chaim Vital, because there the mikvah where you immerse vessels is about this deep, like an arm's length. Many mikvahs where you immerse vessels are very deep. I've lost quite a few vessels and you can't get them out. That's it. I mean, it's over.
But don't make this have to be a certain amount of water in it? I mean, what makes...
So if we have a class on mikvahs, it's a long, long thing. We have to discuss it. It's attached. The bodies of water are attached, meaning they make an area which where it's not where it's shallow, and that's where you, that's hopefully where they make it available to immerse the kedem. So they come back and they tell Moshe, yeah. I don't think so. However you use it. I don't think so. I think we immerse the vessel the way it's normally used. And being that it's used that way, that's how we immerse it. And we went over time, so we'll have to continue the parasha tomorrow night. I